It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, we round up the latest in national politics with a look at the Trans-Pacific trade debate in the Senate and the politics of the Confederate flag. First, Governor Walker held a ceremony in Milwaukee today to sign two bills into law that would expand the rights of gun owners in Wisconsin. The first one eliminates a 48-hour waiting period for purchasing guns, and the other allows off-duty or retired police officers to carry concealed weapons in schools. These and other moves have earned Governor Walker an A-plus rating from the National Rifle Association. Nick Clark is with us now to talk about these bills. He's the chairman and president of Wisconsin Carry, Inc. Nick, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Veronica. Thanks so much. Good to be with you.
Well, I want to start with that first bill. It eliminates the 48-hour waiting period for purchasing guns. Why do you support getting rid of the 48-hour waiting period?
Yeah, a couple of reasons. First, the waiting period itself is something that's actually unique to Wisconsin. Well, not unique to Wisconsin, but only 10 states had that waiting period in the first place for handguns. Now, here in Wisconsin, you've always been able to go buy a shotgun, a rifle, other types of guns, and not have to wait that 48 hours. So this was just the handguns, and only 10 states had that waiting period banned. So most states, 40 states, didn't have that. And so that's one reason, you know, it hasn't been a problem in states that don't have the 48-hour wait. And then the other reason is now with you know, the background checks and technology come back much, much quicker, so they don't need that much time to wait for, you know, calls and those kinds of things. This happens very quickly electronically. And then the last reason would just be for the convenience factor and for safety. There's a lot of people who find themselves, a good example is here in Milwaukee, or Waukesha County, actually, Zena Daniel, who was the victim in that Ozana Salon shooting. So she got a restraining order against her ex-husband, and within, you know, 3 days, he killed her. So that's the kind of, you know, there's victims who need to get guns very quickly sometimes to protect themselves. And these 48-hour waiting periods, you know, if they can't get to the gun store right away, they can be encumbered by that process, and it exposes people to risk. You know, people that live in the inner city of Milwaukee, there's no gun stores in Milwaukee. So for people who live in very high crime areas, you know, they have to travel a long distance to go get a gun, and then they'd have to go back 2 days later and travel that same distance to pick up the gun. So it's really inconvenient, especially for people in the inner city.
Now, to talk about that 48-hour waiting period, the Governor Walker has said this as well, that there's the technology now to speed up that process. How quick is the process? Is it as quick as a couple minutes, or does it take a little bit longer than that?
Yeah, what I'm hearing, and it can vary depending on the time of, you know, day, time of week, and workload, but what I'm hearing is that they're coming back very, very quickly, you know, within minutes of them being submitted. I've heard some circumstances where it takes a little bit longer, but most of them, I think, are coming back very quickly.
Now, critics of this bill have said that the waiting period is an important thing to have because it's also a cooling off period. People might be considering suicide. People might want to use a gun to shoot another person because of a passionate argument. What is your response to losing that cooling off period?
Yeah, I don't know if that really was the case. I don't know if the cooling off period, and that's a very common expression from folks who supported the waiting period. But right now, again, you could go into a gun store and buy a shotgun with no waiting period. That said, people go, you know, if you wanted to commit suicide, you know, you could do that. People, you know, sometimes go to a gun range and rent a gun and commit suicide that way. But in these things like fits of rage, I mean, that's a situation where someone can walk into their kitchen, grab a knife, and go into a fit of rage. I mean, the forces of adrenaline that contribute to that, quote, fit of rage or crime of passion, it's usually something that, you know, a weapon within, you know, your very close proximity. So it's not really the thought that someone would go, you know, drive 20 minutes to a store, go through the purchase process, and that's, you know, people would call, if there's really this crime of passion, that, you know, the adrenaline leaves the body very quickly. And so it would be, at that point, it would be more a calculated thing, which a waiting period wouldn't affect anyway.
We're talking right now with Nick Clark, chairman and president of Wisconsin Carry, Inc., talking about a couple of new gun rights laws that Governor Walker signed just today. Now, the second one allows off-duty and retired law enforcement officers to carry concealed weapons on public school grounds. And you actually say this bill doesn't go far enough. How come?
Yeah, and I depending on which way I look at it, we didn't support this bill for a couple of reasons. And one is that we don't think that we should be creating special privileges for law enforcement, especially, I mean, on-duty police officers can already carrying out their official capacities. But off-duty police officers, I mean, to be honest, we don't view them as any different than any other citizen. And for them to have special privileges, now that this law is passed, someone from, you know, Macon, Georgia can come up here, an off-duty police officer or a former police officer can come to Wisconsin on vacation, go to his nephew's baseball game on school grounds and carry while he does so. But yet me, going to a school where my own kids might go to school, I'm not allowed to carry. That just doesn't seem to make sense to me.
So is that your main disagreement with that bill, that you think it should extend to more citizens and not just law enforcement?
Yeah, absolutely. Here in Wisconsin, it's right now a felony. If I drive onto school property with a gun in the vehicle, even if I never get out of the vehicle, I'm committing a felony. So, and I know that there's thousands of people in Wisconsin that don't realize this, law-abiding concealed carry license holders, and they could accidentally commit a felony and not know it. And I don't think that's how law should be, that law-abiding citizens could accidentally commit a felony. And for that reason, this should have applied to concealed carry license holders. The federal gun-free school zone law allows concealed carry license holders, has an exception for concealed carry license holders. But unfortunately, when Wisconsin passed our school zone law, we didn't have concealed carry, so there was no reason to adopt that exception. So it's really something that I think the state should take up. And I don't think that, again, I would ask legislators why they trust off-duty and former police officers from other states, and they don't trust law-abiding concealed carry license holders from Wisconsin who passed a background check.
And what about the argument that having more guns, especially in a school situation, could make the school less safe? You want to extend it to more citizens, not just police officers and off-duty police officers. What if that gun fell into the wrong hands at school?
Well, I mean, the prohibition against guns, I mean, the notion that it might fall into the wrong hands, I mean, guns are legal to carry in malls and stores and shopping centers and restaurants. And, I was mini golfing the other day and I had a gun with me. So there's thousands of places where children are and guns aren't the problem there. They're not falling out of people's pockets and kids picking them up. So it's really, I think, a non-issue as far as the safety aspect. More so, there's the opportunity where these gun-free school zones, and we say it over and over, and we have repeated examples in the news that these gun-free areas end up being targets of opportunities for criminals. And when someone wants to carry out a mass shooting, they go to a place where guns aren't allowed, and that usually is schools. So obviously we think that when citizens have the right to defend themselves, that's a very important thing, protecting themselves and their kids. We have members of our organization who like to walk their kids to school, and they'd like to be protected when they do so.
Now, we are, as a nation, still recovering from the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, that left 9 people dead. And President Obama made some remarks about guns in America shortly after that shooting. He said Americans are 20 times as likely to die from gun violence as citizens of other civilized countries. To put that question to you, are guns part of that problem?
No, absolutely not. In fact, the tragedy here, and this is what I think everybody is missing, is that, we're now talking about flags and this kind of thing with this South Carolina situation. If one of those people in that church would have had a gun, I'm pretty confident that that there probably would have only been one casualty, and that only casualty may have been the lunatic who went in there to harm people. I think people need to realize that there's evil in the world, and we're never going to rid the world of all evil. But what we can do is encourage people to protect themselves. And if they do that, that situation in Texas where two lunatics came to, the cartoon convention, the only people that died in that situation were the two lunatics. So, no loss of life is acceptable for innocent people, but the best we can do is give people the opportunity to encourage them to protect themselves. And I wish that's what would have been the case in Texas, in South Carolina. I wish one of those people would have had a gun, because there's people that would be alive today if one of them did.
Nick, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much, Veronica.
That was Nick Clark, chairman and president of Wisconsin Carry, Inc. He was with us to talk about two laws Governor Walker signed into law today, expanding the rights of gun owners. We head to Washington for the latest in national politics. The Confederate flag has become the subject of heavy political debate, with an increasing number of Republican politicians saying it's time to take the flag down. Also yesterday, the Senate moved President Obama's trade agenda forward, advancing fast-track authority for a trans-Pacific trade agreement. The move keeps the bill alive after it stalled 2 weeks ago. Also, we're going to hear about the latest polling on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Here with us now is Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. Harry, good to have you.
Thanks for having me on.
So the biggest public debate after the Charleston shooting last week hasn't been about guns. It's been about the Confederate flag. How did the flag become the center of this national conversation?
Well, the flag became a center of this conversation because the lunatic, or, you know, you can call him a terrorist. People have been calling him different names. He has dressed himself in the Confederate flag. There are numerous pictures with him and the Confederate flag. And the Confederate flag in South Carolina has had a long history going well back to the 1960s and then obviously before that to the Civil War. And basically, African Americans in that state for a long time have wanted the Confederate flag not to fly on public property. And 15 years ago, there was this debate, and we've had it now again. And basically, the South Carolina legislators, the governor, and specifically Nikki Haley, has led this charge to say, we are not going to have this flag. It belongs in a museum. You can fly it on private land, but it's not going to be flown on public property, not while I'm governor. And we are seeing a whole lot of Republicans who previously have been silent on the issue, including the presidential candidates, basically getting behind Haley, because that is where the wind is. Look, nine people are dead. They want to make a statement somehow, some way, saying that this is not okay, and African Americans are a part of the Democratic base, and Republicans want to eat into that Democratic base in the 2016 election. And more than that, what we know is that Republicans do not want to be seen as this all-white party. This is sort of one of those gateway issues that sort of, if they were saying, no, we're okay with the Confederate flag, then, you know, you can make the jump fairly easily to then saying, well, are you okay then, you know, with racism? People who defend the flag will obviously say that it's about, you know, Southern pride. But at this point, after so many people are dead, the momentum is on the side of saying, you know what, maybe it's time that we take this flag down.
Right. So Governor Nikki Haley has been at the leading edge of this, and Republicans have been rallying behind her. This has been, as you said, a sticky point for Republicans in the past. So how big a deal was this move for a Republican governor to get out in front of it and take a stand and have everyone else fall into line behind her on this?
I don't think that there is a single political analyst really out there who doesn't recognize at least the political genius of what Haley is doing. You know, regardless of how you feel about the merits of whether the Confederate flag should be flown on public property or not, it's very clear where the wind was blowing, and Haley came out very, very strongly. And it, you know, it certainly saved a lot of the Republican candidates who always talk about quote-unquote state rights. You know, before Haley came out, you know, Jeb Bush, who was one of the more forceful people on the Confederate flag, saying that it should be removed. He did remove it from public property in Florida, sort of didn't say that, you know, she should take it down right now. South Carolina shouldn't run, you know, shouldn't have it on public property. He's more saying, look, I hope that they come to the right decision, and I trust the state officials will. And so Haley came to what I think Jeb Bush would call the right decision, and that has allowed the Republican candidate to say, good for Nikki Haley, we stand behind her, and sort of takes this sticky point issue out whereby, you know, Hillary Clinton can come out very strongly against the Confederate flag, and the Republicans who might not want to alienate more conservative voters or might not want to be seen as impending upon state rights.
Is that going to hurt any of the Republican candidates who kind of dragged their feet, either wouldn't answer or maybe seem to be supportive of leaving the flag flying before Haley came out? Does it hurt them at all?
You know, I think we're so far from the primary that this type of, you know, the news cycles move so fast these days, right? And so what happens now isn't necessarily going to really matter in 6 months. But what will be interesting to see if there are any Republican candidates out there who, you know, may say, no, this is a, you know, not only a states' rights issue, but the Confederate flag is about Southern pride. I know Mike Huckabee has sort of been toeing the line on that. And you have to keep in mind, in South Carolina, at least before we had this shooting, there were a lot of Republican voters, in fact, the vast majority of Republican voters who were okay with the flag flying, or at least not against it. And there are a lot of upstate, you know, in South Carolina, it tends to be more liberal areas around Columbia and towards the coast in Charleston are much more liberal areas than the upstate of South Carolina, which is a lot more conservative. And a lot of the legislators who represent the upstate have stayed silent on this issue because they're hoping that it will simply move on, and a lot of their constituents still support the flag being on public property. And so it will be very interesting to see if, in fact, there are going to be a few Republican presidential candidates who are trying to gain some votes who say, you know what, it is about Southern pride. That's going to be, I think, the more interesting issue moving forward.
And before we leave this topic behind, Nikki Haley as a vice presidential pick, do you think that could happen now?
I think it could have happened before, but I have learned in my years of doing this that predicting vice presidential candidates is a very dangerous thing to do for an analyst, and you can come out looking very foolish. So I'm not going to make a prediction on that, merely to say that she is part of the conversation.
Talking right now to Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538. We're catching up right now on national politics. Moving on to the 2016 race more broadly, Hillary Clinton seems to be picking up some steam again. For a while, she was maybe sagging a little in the numbers. She had Bernie Sanders nipping at her heels. She had Republican rivals nipping at her heels. What do you think about where she is now? Is she cresting again?
I would say that, you know, most of the polling that had shown her potentially having problems in a Democratic primary, I personally have thought that Clinton was going to go all the way, you know, in terms of at least winning the nomination for a while. And the polling that showed her sort of falling down, especially in the state of New Hampshire, which is obviously the first primary and the second contest of the Iowa caucus. Look, even people who have won the nominations easily, I look to Al Gore, who crushed the field, which was only Bill Bradley in 2001, all 50 state primaries and caucuses, even he trailed in the New Hampshire polls for a while. I went to school in New Hampshire. I've lived in New Hampshire. New Hampshireites don't like being told what to do. They want to come to their own decision. But eventually they'll probably come around. And even if Clinton lost that primary, if you look at the national polling, you know, there was an NBC poll out this week from NBC News and Wall Street Journal, which had her at 75% of the Democratic primary vote. Last time around in 2008, she at best was reaching 50 and usually was stuck in the mid-30s to high 30s. She's far and ahead, far better than she was 8 years ago. She is the strongest non-incumbent to run for a party's nomination since primaries and caucuses decided candidates in 1972.
A couple weeks ago, though, we were seeing these stories about Bernie Sanders, people going, hey, look at him. He's picking up steam. Could he be a contender? What do you think about those? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I mean, that came from New Hampshire. I mean, that is exactly where that came from. You know, there was a few polls out from the state of New Hampshire which showed him about 10 points back. I think one was 10 and one was 12. And people said, oh, my God, look at Bernie Sanders. He's surging. But remember, he's from next door in Vermont. New Hampshire is a state that is very, very white. Bernie Sanders does not poll well among African Americans. And once the contest moved to states that are more diverse than either Iowa or New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton will pick up an advantage as she appeals to minority voters a lot better, and also her big money edge will be able to pound Sanders on the airwaves. If I'm Hillary Clinton, I'm not exactly worried about a 75-year-old socialist from Vermont.
Okay, what about Donald Trump? Is she going to be worried about him and other Republicans, for that matter? He seems to be surging in New Hampshire at number two. What do you make of that?
I can just say, are you not entertained? If you are not entertained by the idea of Donald Trump running in second place in a presidential primary, then you are just never going to be entertained by politics in your life. Donald Trump has no chance of winning the Republican nomination. We don't always look at the horse race numbers, you know, who's ahead and who's behind. We also look at how voters view each of the individual candidates, you know, whether they view them favorably or unfavorably. And we have something called a net favorability rating, which is essentially the favorable number minus the unfavorable number. And Donald Trump has the worst net favorable rating of any candidate to run for a party nomination within his own party ever. I think it was 106 candidates I looked up, and it was the worst ever. A majority of Republicans nationally view him unfavorably. When that's the case, you just can't win a party nomination. He'll be entertaining. I'll love it if he gets into the debates. We'll all have a good laugh, but nothing beyond that.
All right, well, I have a feeling we'll talk about him again. And in the meantime, we're going to end with fast-track legislation for the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement yesterday, looking to get a green light. What do you make of that? Does that bode well for the passage of the whole thing?
I believe it does. Yeah, it definitely bodes well. Look, this has been a very interesting, contentious point between Obama, who wanted, you know, fast track and wants these free trade agreements, and House Democrats who didn't. But Obama figured out that you could pass the fast track for the trade with enough Republican votes. And then what you'll do afterwards is you'll get this assistance, sort of this trade assistance for people who are displaced or hurt by free trade. And he has made it part of a package with the Republicans where they'll first pass the free trade, the fast track for the free trade, and then he has an agreement with the Democrats who realize that they're behind the eight ball in this situation, that they just can't win, that they'll eventually pass the assistance for those who are displaced or hurt by free trade. It's going to pass almost certainly unless something unforeseen happens. But you know what? It is politics, so nothing's guaranteed.
Harry, thanks a lot for talking today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Harry Enten, senior political writer and analyst for 538, talking about the latest in national politics. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Now that high school and college students have graduated, many of them are considering their next moves in life. And for a lot of these Wisconsinites, moving out of state to a big city on the coast is one of the standard options on the table. And Wisconsin can be seen as having a brain drain problem, where a lot of young talent who grow up in the state leave when they graduate, maybe come back years later to raise families. But our next guest says you shouldn't move to New York City or Los Angeles. A lot of those same opportunities, he says, are right there in your hometown. He's lived in the Midwest his whole life, and he wouldn't have it any other way. And we're taking your calls on this. Have you ever lived on the coast in New York or Los Angeles, San Francisco? Why did you make that move, and did it pay off? Or do you find what you need staying in the Midwest? Are you missing out, do you think? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Andrew Winnestorfer joins us now. He's the author of To Hell With All That, Why I'll Never Move to New York or Los Angeles. He's a freelance writer, and he joins us now in the studio. Andrew, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
So why do you say you'd never move to New York or Los Angeles?
I think that's a complicated question and answer, but I think as I lay out in the piece, I feel like the Midwest, and I guess Madison specifically, since I live here, all of the same opportunities for culture, for jobs, they're all available here without the having to move across country away from everybody I know, and without like the overpopulation, the high rents that come with living on the coast.
Now, to be clear, a lot of people who live in what's called flyover country like Wisconsin, they might live near a bigger metropolitan area. For instance, you might live in Eau Claire and move to Minneapolis, St. Paul, or something like that. Are you including that in the big city folk, or are you specifically talking about the coast?
I mean, it's specifically about the coasts. The reason I wrote this piece was there's like a, if you pay attention to like sites like Gawker or, the New York Times even, there's a lot of people that write like very long, flowery pieces about why they want to, live in New York or why they're leaving New York for LA. And I, as somebody who's lived in the Midwest, those pieces just always feel like we're left out, like we are flyover country to these people. And I felt like there hasn't been anything written from that perspective of like, you should just stay in the Midwest or stay in Minneapolis. Like, so I'm not including, like, as I say in the piece, like, there's nothing wrong with, instead of moving to New York, you move to Raleigh, like, if you're from North Carolina, or moving to Minneapolis if you're from Eau Claire.
Well, why do you think there has been kind of this ongoing, maybe it's fair to call it a mythology about the young person packing their suitcase going to pursue their big dreams in New York or L.A.? Why has that persisted so much if it is, as you say, pretty okay staying where you are?
I think it's years of being told that by everything, pretty much, that, like, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. The old mythology of moving there. But I think there's this conception that for a lot of people, and I work with a lot of college kids on my day job, and there's like a perception that you have failed if you haven't at least like attempted going to New York or LA. And I don't think that that's fair, I guess.
Of course, you've lived here your whole life to play devil's advocate. How do you know there wouldn't be a really happy, super successful version of you in New York or LA when you haven't tried it?
I mean, there very well could be, but there also could be like a very successful version of myself, like on Mars. Like it's like it's theoretical. But I also feel like I haven't scraped, like even just living in the Midwest, like scraped everything that I can out of living here. Like I feel like people that pack up and move don't give this the same kind of like, you know, flowery attitudes about living here that they do living on the coast.
Well, people often go to the coast, it seems like, because they want a few things. They want a vibrant cultural scene. They want economic opportunity. They want to be able to network with a lot of people who might be doing the same kinds of things that they're doing. Can you do that in a smaller place when there might not be, for one thing, as many people living there?
I mean, there is certainly, like, if you want to be in movies, I think you probably have to move to L.A. But, you know, I guess I'm a case for why you don't need to. Like, I write for publications like Vice and have a network of people who I only know over the internet. Like, a lot of them I've never met in person. I feel like the internet has leveled that in a way that you don't need to build a network in New York. Is it harder for me that I don't get to like see editors like at bars in Williamsburg or in Silver Lake every night? Probably. Like I'm probably not getting as much opportunity from proximity, but I have a network of people like all over the country that I know that I can push for assignments or get work.
We're talking right now to freelance writer Andrew Winnisdorfer about why he says he would never move to New York or Los Angeles. He wrote about this recently for Vice magazine. And Andrew, what do you think you get about staying put? What do you get in exchange for some of those other bigger things, bigger marquee things you might think you're going to get on the coast? What does it give you to stay put?
I mean, for one, the quality of life here, I think, is considerably better for my friends that are freelance writers in New York. I have an apartment that is like four times bigger than what they live in. I, you know, can eat more affordably than they can. And I think just the general less like I mentioned this in the piece, but like the general lack of like the competition, I guess, is something that I appreciate about living here, is that I don't feel like I have to get into like a lion's den to be able to write anywhere like you do in New York to get noticed.
Do you think there's more people here that are willing to give you a leg up? You know, I'm thinking, I guess, a little bit about the music scene in Eau Claire, where talking to musicians who come through WPR, a lot of people say that they're able to get a leg up thanks to the success of Justin Vernon. Do you think the same is true for other people in small communities, say in Wisconsin, that wouldn't be true in New York or LA?
I mean, I think it's a lot easier to be connected to the, you know, movers and shakers in your community when you're in somewhere like Madison as opposed to New York, where I, you know the editor of the Isthmus. I know the editor of Tone Madison, the big, you know, culture blog in Madison. I think the ability to be like closer to those people is like a leg up as opposed to being in New York, where you're one of, like I said in the piece, there's like 750,000 college grads moved to New York every 5 years. Whereas, you know, so you're one of however many there are doing the same thing you're doing there.
And what about just having a broad base of life experience? If you lived here, you probably know what a cheese curd is by now. You know your favorite restaurants. You know the movers and shakers. Do you think that it, I don't know, can make you small-minded by just staying where you are?
I think you could be small-minded if you live in New York or L.A. as well. I think you have to work to uncover like the different elements of your culture wherever you are. In the Midwest, it is certainly harder. I mean, especially somewhere in Madison, you have to work harder to find, you know, like the restaurants that challenge you, or the music or the writing that challenges you. But it's certainly here.
We're going to go to our callers now. We've got Les on the line in Monroe. Hi, Les.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
I totally agree, gentlemen, because my wife and I, we traveled and lived in Los Angeles just previous to our move to Wisconsin. I was born and raised in Wisconsin, and we've been gone quite a while. And I worked as a private chef, and when I was ready to start a restaurant, I very easily could have stayed in that area, LA, and started. You certainly have millions of people that you can try and attract, but I love Wisconsin. I like the life. I like the climate, and I knew that a small town would almost be more challenging than a big city, because when you get there, not as many people, they're going to take a real good look at you, and you better be good right out of the blocks and prove that you know what you're doing. But once we did it, just like the gentleman said, we've gotten to know the movers and shakers of this community, of this region, and it's been really beneficial. We're just great people, and we, you know each other. It's a small-town atmosphere. Out in L.A., there's 12 million people in the general area there, and boy, sometimes you just feel like a speck out there. I'm very happy being in a small town in Wisconsin.
Unless, do you miss anything about Los Angeles? Anything at all that you feel like you can't get here in Wisconsin?
Well, you're a little closer. You're closer to more cultural events and things like that. But then we always found that the crush of the highways and moving around, even just going up PCH to Malibu, it wasn't fun because you're packed in cars in bad traffic. And the quality of life isn't as good. Those sunny days along the Pacific, absolutely great. Walking our dog, you know, along Palisades Park are special moments. But day in, day out, the quality of life here is just so pleasant, you know.
All right. Appreciate your thoughts, Les. Thanks for calling up. Sound familiar? Do you agree with everything there?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I think, you know, the idea that you don't have to spend half of your life in traffic like you do to live in L.A. is, you know, an undersold part of living here.
We're talking right now to freelance writer Andrew Winnestorfer about why he says he'd never move to New York or Los Angeles. He's lived in the Midwest his whole life. He just wrote about this for Vice magazine. And we're taking your calls on this. Do you think living in a big city on the coast is all it's cracked up to be? Did you try it? How did it work out for you? Did you come back like Les did? Or does Wisconsin have all the ingredients that you need for a happy life and a good job? What would it take to get you to leave Wisconsin, and what do you think you'd miss? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now with freelance writer Andrew Winnestorfer. He's lived in the Midwest his whole life, and he says he'd never move to New York or Los Angeles. And we want to know what you think about this. Do you think living in a big city on the coast is all it's cracked up to be? Have you tried it? Do you have any regrets about leaving? Did you come back? Do you think Wisconsin can fulfill the needs you have for a happy life and a good job? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're going to go to our phones now. We have Ellen joining us first in Madison. Ellen, hi.
Hi.
What is your story about the Midwest?
Well, I'm a transplant. I've lived in Los Angeles, Seattle, and San Francisco, and I miss each of those cities for various reasons. And I love Madison. The people are friendly, and it's great in the summertime and sometimes in the winter. But there's just no comparison to the stimulation you can get in a big city.
So you think there was more going on there. So why have you chosen, at least for now, to stay in Wisconsin, in Madison?
My husband's job, we relocated here.
Okay, but it sounds like you miss some of the happenings in those bigger places.
I miss the street action. I miss looking at what people are wearing. It's not just, you know, college school wear. I miss hearing different languages and being able to eat like Ethiopian food one night and another, and music and art, just all of it. I think your caller should spend like a good month in a big city.
Ellen, appreciate your call. Okay, so the gauntlet thrown down, Andrew. She just gave a pretty compelling list of some things that she thinks big cities have to offer. Fashion on the streets, lots of ethnic cuisine available, the art scene. And she says you should try it. What do you say?
I mean, I think the ethnic food scene, if you go to the food carts on Library Mall every day, like, you can get a pretty wide sample of ethnic cuisine. Now, there may be
in Madison, there's
in
a
Madison,
bunch of them.
Yeah, in Madison, there's quite a variety. But I mean, I get, you know, there's not the bevy of entertainment options, I guess. Like, it would be less. Like, I'm not necessarily arguing that, like, Madison has less music venues than has better music venues or more music venues than LA. But I think if you work hard enough and like the place where you are, you can find that kind of action anywhere.
So you're saying you maybe have to dig a little deeper.
Yes. You have to work harder. And I think Midwestern people, we do work harder, right?
All right, Ellen, thank you for that call. Appreciate it. And we're going to go next to Dwight in Duluth, Minnesota. Dwight, hi.
Hi. I moved out into the... I'm a retired business owner right now, but I moved out to L.A. in the 80s. And I absolutely did not like it either. It was, you know, the former caller, Ellen, she's right about, yeah, you want to find places to eat, you need a different restaurant every night the rest of your life. But as far as living there, is that worth it? It wasn't to me. I thought the people were kind of shallow. They just weren't as genuine as Midwesterners. And the smog was terrible. I had red eyes the whole time I was there. And the driving, you have this thing called the Thompson Bible that you have to live with. And driving was a nightmare. And like you said, you live half your life in a car. That sucks when it comes to life as far as I'm concerned. So as far as people going out there, hey, it's a great place to visit, to live there. You're crazy.
What is a Townsend Bible?
That's a huge road map of every city in of L.A., and it's about 4 or 5 inches thick.
All right, so interesting. I never knew that. I've been to L.A. several times, and I was not aware of this. I've GPSed it when I've gone there. But anyway, what about that bigger point? He's saying, well, for one thing, people he's saying are more authentic in the Midwest. Do you buy that?
I do, but I'm probably biased, right? But I think here you get people are, like I say in the piece about Eau Claire, like people here just treat you like more like fair than they do in LA. There isn't any cachet to really being a celebrity in the Midwest.
Right. In your piece, you say Justin Vernon from Bon Iver would have to stand in line. He couldn't cut in line if he wanted to go to a bar in Eau Claire.
Yeah. And I really, that's something that as I've gotten older, I really appreciate about the Midwest as I have traveled to New York and like Philadelphia, where there isn't much of a status in being a celebrity here. Like we just treat people all the same. It's a leveling experience to live here, I think.
That sounds both good and bad when you say it that way. All right.
I think it's good.
Appreciate that, Dwight. And let's move on to Susan and Toma. Susan, hi.
Hi. It's interesting. The last two calls have really brought up some of the issues related to the point I wanted to make, is I think the concept between the Midwest and the coast is so much based upon who's the body who's talking. I'm somebody who's mixed heritage. Multiple friends of color that are in my life have at various points moved out to the coast, not because of fashion or because of anything like that, but just because of a weariness with living in a culture that continually centers a European or a white set of beliefs and ways of doing things, and just a desire to live on a coast where there are, quote-unquote, even more people like them, or just a more of a complexity of culture, so that, for example, their food is not necessarily ethnic food, or that they instead it's just home food, but in a different culture or in a different community, and where some of the, you know, microaggressions that just happens from living in a culture that largely doesn't see you are not as existent. So I think the moving from the Midwest to the coast, when we live in a Midwest that has only been really a single generation that has had large communities of color in our cities, outside obviously Chicago and Cleveland and the industrial cities, I think it can also be about a different kind of survival choice.
All right, Susan, thank you. Some really thoughtful points there from Susan about maybe the homogeneity of culture in the Midwest. And if that's not you, if you don't look like that, this might not always feel like home. Point about ethnic food, quote unquote, well taken too, as well, Susan. What about that, that this might not feel like home to everybody?
I guess you have to move in that scenario. I mean, you know, you want to feel at home wherever you live. And I guess my point of my piece is that I feel at home here and don't need to move to New York or LA.
Is that a flaw in the Midwest, though, that there isn't as much diversity as there could be, as you certainly get in New York or Los Angeles?
Yes. I mean, yeah. I don't know how to qualify that other than yes, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for bringing those points up, Susan. Appreciate that. And Karen is joining us next from Green Bay. Hi, Karen.
Hi there.
What is your take?
The only coast I've lived on is in Texas, in Houston. I travel a lot to New York for art and culture. And I was kind of amused by the caller from Madison who feels culturally maybe a little bit deprived, because we go to Madison from Green Bay to get some culture. So when you live in Green Bay, as fun as the Packers are, it's pretty hard to find other things to do there. And it does get a little tedious at times.
And have you done what Andrew suggested and tried to dig deep into your community in Green Bay there?
Yes. And there are small enclaves of cultural things to do. Hard to find out about them sometimes. And certainly not the kind of attendance that you would see at the sporting events and things in the area.
All right. Karen, thanks a lot for that call. Andrew?
I mean, yeah, I think... you know, that's something maybe we could talk about, is that if anything, the small town cultural events need to have better advertising, because it is tough to find. I'm from Oshkosh originally, and there was plenty of stuff happening there that you didn't find out about.
Well, Andrew, we leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Veronica.
That was Andrew Wittestorfer, freelance writer and the author of To Hell With All That, Why I'll Never Move to New York or Los Angeles. You can find a link to his article over on the Central Time Facebook page. Some sad news to share. Well-known film composer James Horner died Monday in a plane crash near Santa Barbara, California. He's known for his scores for Field of Dreams, Braveheart, and the movie Avatar. He's also won two Academy Awards in 1997 for his work on the movie Titanic, Best Dramatic Score, and Best Original Song for this one, still a tearjerker after all these years.
Every night in my dreams, I see you, I feel you, that is how I know you go on.
In a 2009 interview with the Los Angeles Times, Horner said, "My job is to make sure at every turn of the film, it's something the audience can feel with its heart." He definitely hit the mark with Titanic. James Horner was 61 years old.